Coming up, it's all politics from NPR News.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin. And Ron, welcome back a week and a half away in California.
Last week, of course, I joined you, Ken, from the remote studios at Stanford University. And it's a pleasure to be back and seeing you in the flesh.
well, we'll talk about that later.
And I believe there's probably a little bit more.
But this is the real America. Washington, D.C. is the real America, not wherever you were. Don't you think this is the real
America? It's good to be back in the whatever this is other than the country.
This is where we live.
This is where we do
a lot of news, a lot of politic news.
Yes. And let's start with that big Kentucky governor's race you've been wanting to talk about all fall.
I know.
Real squeaker.
Well, no, it wasn't actually. But the interesting thing was not so much.
Only 20-point loss.
No, to Steve Beshear, who, as you know, lost to Mitch McConnell in 1996. But the big news, I thought, was what happened in Virginia.
Yes, absolutely. The taking of one of the chambers of the state legislature by the Democratic Party.
Big news because the Democrats have been making gains in Virginia. We saw that with two successive gubernatorial victories. George Allen was defeated last year.
That was on top of the gubernatorial victories.
Warner will probably replace Warner next year. But now they've taken the four seats they needed for the state Senate. Again, it's another purpling of what had been heretofore a kind of a red state.
And now we have a Virginia that is at the very least going to be competitive in statewide races and possibly in the presidential race in 2008. Are we prepared to go that far?
No. And the reason I say no is because we kind of thought the same thing 4 years ago when the Democrats were making their first move in Virginia. And you had John Edwards, not a favorite son of Virginia, but certainly a Southerner on the ticket. And how many Southern states did the Kerry Edwards take? I think zero.
Zero would be the number.
That was correct.
Yes. And I don't see Virginia becoming that much more competitive in terms of congressional seats. I think they're going to remain a predominantly Republican delegation in the House.
Except the one seat you have to watch out for is Tom Davis, the guy who was supposed to run for the Senate. He backed out at the last minute and probably wisely because I don't know if anybody could stop Mark Warner. And he also has a pretty tenuous hold on his Northern Virginia seat. He's a kind of a moderate Republican.
But maybe not moderate enough in a time when Northern Virginia is trending strongly Democratic.
And conservatives see him as a rhino, a Republican in name only. So I suspect that Davis might not even run again. His wife was defeated as one of the state senators who were lost in the Democratic victory this week. So
let's talk about the national political scene, though. Ken, there's been some big developments on the national political scene this week. Among them, a split among the endorsements of prominent members of the Christian conservative movement. I'm talking here about Pat Robertson.
Backing Rudy Giuliani.
Talking about,
which makes complete sense.
We can talk about whether or not it makes sense in a moment. We're talking also about Paul Warrick of the Free Congress Foundation, one of the people who had been a founder, really, of the entire movement. And he decided to go with Mitt Romney, even though Mitt Romney is not an evangelical Christian.
As has Bob Jones III.
Bob Jones III. As in Bob Jones University. Why are none of these endorsements going to Mike Huckabee, who is, after all, an evangelical Baptist ministry?
Yeah, I thought of that. That's a very good question. It's about time you asked a good question. There was a very interesting article in the Wall Street Journal a week or so again by John Fund, who wrote about basically that Mike Huckabee was not the conservative he's selling himself as when he was governor of Arkansas. He raised taxes.
Oh, my God.
He did raise taxes. Yeah.
Well, this would certainly upset John Fund. But I thought that the social conservatives were more concerned about issues such as abortion,
right?
Gay marriage,
right?
School prayer.
But this podcast?
I would think that that would be the driving factor that would really control the endorsements of a Pat Robertson or a Paul.
And that's why he went to the logical person, Rudy Giuliani.
Who's in favor of all those things.
Exactly.
That's right.
Except for the podcast.
Except for the podcast. So why, Ken?
Well, there are several reasons. One, he is taken, as many people are with Giuliani, with his shepherding of New York City, which was, let's face it, it was a filth, crime, drug infested, and that's why we should have the podcast there for more often.
But it was too much. The shepherding is such a good choice of word.
Thanks.
Was very nice.
Thanks.
So the shepherding of New York City from filth to faith.
Right. Yes. Your lift is getting worse. And that and the crime and drugs and And, of course, not to mention that thing that happened in September, or the 12th or something.
9/11.
Giuliani doesn't seem to mention that often. But what's so remarkable, because if you think of the 9/10 Rudy Giuliani and earlier was...
You mean the Rudy Giuliani who existed before the terrorist attacks on New York City.
He was pro-gay rights. He was...
In favor of abortion rights.
He took on the NRA.
He wore fruit on his head and danced as Carmen Miranda.
That's right.
And you've seen that on YouTube.
That's why we read Rudy Giuliani His Rights, because of that Carmen Miranda thing. Do you get that one?
I do. Yeah. I do get that joke, and I'm trying to move on as quickly as possible.
Okay.
All right. But Sam Brownback, who was another serious social conservative, serious religious conservative, who had been running for president himself, when he dropped out of the race, did not go for one of the top two or top three front runners in his party. He endorsed John McCain, who's been anathema to a lot of the social.
Well, actually, if my memory is correct, I remember Ron Elving in a previous podcast expecting him to endorse Rudy Giuliani.
I did. I did say that, and I did expect him to endorse Rudy Giuliani because I thought that Sam Brownback would be going with the main chance.
What the f*** were you thinking, Ron?
Well, I guess I was just wrong, Ken. Sam Brownback continues to demonstrate that he is a person driven to a large degree by principle. This may be why he didn't do better as a presidential candidate.
And the issue in this case?
The issue in this case is abortion. Right. And he says John McCain's been with us on this issue all the way.
No,
all the way back.
No flip-flopping.
No questions.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
And why not stick with the guy who's stuck with us? I think you have to doff your hat to that.
I don't wear a hat. But if I did, I would doff it. I'll doff it all right. Also, do you think that any of these endorsements mean anything in the long run?
Yes, I do. I think they mean, among other things, that the social conservative or religious conservative movement that has been increasingly powerful in the Republican Party over the last 30 years is on the brink of some kind of a crack-up in the next year. I think we could see a third-party candidate coming from this movement. I think there's going to be a great deal of unhappiness among them, even if one of the people that some of these folks are endorsing, say Rudy Giuliani, winds up as the nominee, a lot of the other people are going to be unhappy. If there were a candidate they could really rally behind, that candidate would have emerged, and that candidate has not emerged.
You know, one person who did not get any of these endorsements was the guy who was supposed to save the Republican Party, and that's your friend Fred Thompson from Tennessee.
Okay, you're reminding me again that I was taking Fred Thompson's promise seriously back last
spring.
As
was everybody.
And I was saying, gosh, you know, here's a guy who could come in, and a lot of Southern conservatives, because he's from Tennessee, because he talks like a Southerner, because he seems to embody, as Ronald Reagan seemed to embody, a lot of these values, this could be the guy they could flock to. Hasn't happened.
He has become less Ronald Reagan and more Walter Brennan, I suspect. And the reason I say that is because Walter Brennan was one of the great justices of the Supreme Court.
Oh, yes. Yes. Yes, yes indeed.
Justice.
Why didn't Fred Thompson connect with this book?
Well, his debate performances were not energetic, shall we say. He has not had much of an energetic schedule on the campaign tour. He kind of says a lot of platitudes, doesn't say much, and he really is not exciting the crowd.
Is there a lifestyle factor here? I mean, we've just learned in the last week that one of his main fundraisers, one of the four founders of his campaign, as he described it, was a fellow who had a past as a drug dealer. Now, it's 20 years ago and more that these things happened. But apparently Fred Thompson was never told that this man had been investigated for cocaine trafficking and bookmaking and had actually pled guilty to transporting 11 pounds of marijuana for sale.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that because I think Rudy Giuliani had no idea that Bernie Kerik was in any kind of trouble either. That's a good segue.
That is an excellent segue. And a lot of people are taking a look back to Rudy Giuliani, somebody who a lot of us did not think could fly in the Republican Party because of his history, because of his views on social issues, and also because of his personal life. But here we see him being endorsed, as we've said, by Pat Robertson. And now he's going to be taking another hit because his old pal, Bernie Kerik, the man he put in charge of the police force whom he still defends, has gone from being, a full employment act for investigative reporters to actually being indicted for crimes.
You know, I remember you saying in this podcast several months ago, saying that your sense of what Giuliani was all about is that voters really don't know that he's pro-choice and all these liberal on these issues. All they see is 9/11 and terrorism, and that's all they care about. They don't know. But I'm wondering if people do know all these things, and they're just, it's just not, I mean, the ultimate Teflon candidate. I'm not saying that he doesn't have high negatives, and he does have negatives, but I'm just thinking that all the things that you think would disqualify him with the Pat Robertsons and the conservatives of the world, they're out there in plain view, the link to corruption.
In plain view does not mean that people have viewed them. Just the fact that they're visible does not mean that people have focused in on it. I would say right now, if you name-tested Bernie Kerik here in Washington, where we know what happened to his nomination to be the Homeland Security czar, and we know because of that, some of his past history in New York or in New York City, where you can come from.
That's right.
People do know the name Bernie Kerik. I'll bet if you name tested that outside of Washington and New York, I just don't think people out there know yet about Bernie Kerik. And this indictment is not going to do it all by itself. But what if we get into a trial situation next year during election year?
I was going to say, we have 50, 55 days to go before Iowa, before the voting starts. When is it time? Are we the media not doing our job?
Are we the media not doing our job?
Are we, the media, not doing our job?
Good time to move on to another topic. Ron Paul, still not doing terribly well in the national polls, where he's stuck in low single digits. But he came up with a fundraising device this week that was a true 10-strike. He had a one-day Ron Paul mass donation day on the internet and raised in one day $4.3 million.
Perhaps even more. There's some talk about it as close as $5 million, right.
Okay, which is more, by the way, than, say, Mike Huckabee has raised in the entire year.
Well, or look at this, or the erstwhile frontrunner John McCain in the last quarter. Mm-hmm. I think he outraised him as well. We keep dismissing Ron Paul. We know that we're getting, you know, the emails constantly from his supporters who, you know, when they return from Neptune, they say, why aren't you covering Ron Paul? But yet, there has to be something there.
Yeah, no, let's be fair. I mean, we've used the Neptune line before, say, about Mike Gravel and other marginal candidates. Right. But Ron Paul represents a philosophy, libertarianism. He represents a group of people within the Republican Party who really have no other candidate who speaks for their anti-government sentiments, which extend to having a non-interventionist foreign policy. And as a result of the UN, the gold standard, these are strong views. But they are views that have many advocates within the Republican Party and beyond, among the independents, among that third of Americans who don't identify with either party. And I wonder, even if he is still low in the national polls, if he isn't going to be heard from in 2008.
Well, you know, we're mentioning all these anti-government, these so-called, these small L libertarian views, but we're also not mentioning his opposition to the war. And that is not a small significance. I was just on a program.
He's more against the war than Hillary Clinton.
That's right. That's right. He's unalterably opposed to the war.
And so he could be
and
a
he
candidate.
Voted against it. He was one of the six Republicans
that
who voted against it in 2003.
And he stands up and takes abuse at a lot of the Republican debates. He actually gets booed.
Right.
And Rudy Giuliani beats up on him for being naive about al-Qaeda. But what if he ran as a third-party candidate who was more against the war and more against the federal government than either of the two major candidates?
I had not thought of it. He has not ruled that out yet. He has not pledged to endorse the Republican nominee.
And is this not the message of what he did this particular week, or of these events he has planned for Veterans Day, Constitution Day, anniversary of the Boston Tea Party?
Now, here's the thing. I mean, I was on this program, WOSU, in Columbus, Ohio, and there was a caller who said he was a liberal Democrat who was going to switch to the Republican Party because he wanted to vote for Ron Paul. I mean, given the fact that he probably disagrees with Paul on every other issue other than the war, the fact is Paul has this way, this quirkiness, I think, that appeals to liberal Democrats and old, you know, protectionist slash Birch. Birchers.
Birchers.
I know, you know, anti-UN, anti-the Federal Reserve.
Quirkiness. Let's mention quirkiness here in context of the Democratic Party. What about Dennis Kucinich taking to the floor a resolution to impeach Dick Cheney, the vice president?
Well, I don't think it was quirkiness at all because, as far as I saw, 165 Republicans voted with him.
No, they voted to bring it to the floor because they wanted to embarrass the Democratic
Party.
Well,
of course.
We being fair now?
No, we are being fair. But okay.
Dennis
Kucinich got a point of personal privilege to bring this to the floor. As soon as the Democrats were elected in 2006, Nancy Pelosi said that impeachment is not on the table. It's not going to happen.
That was impeachment of George Bush, of course.
Well, Bush-Cheney, whatever, about mishandling the intelligence to go to war against Iraq.
So
as soon as Dennis Kucinich announced this resolution on the floor, Steny Hoyer came out and basically offered a bill to table it or kill it.
That would be the Democratic leadership through the voice of Steny Hoyer.
Right. So you have Steny Hoyer and Nancy Pelosi versus Dennis Kucinich and the 20 or so Democrats who really are pushing for impeachment. Suddenly the Republicans said, wait a second, why should we vote to kill this? I mean, let Pelosi have her debate with Kucinich. Let's show who the, what's the left wing or what's the far left wing of the Democratic Party. So Republicans were having a lot of fun with it this week.
Okay, so all this really amounts to the kind of internal political energy that goes on in the House of Representatives, where they like to beat on each other about things they're never going to really vote on or do anything about. Or is this Dennis Kucinich, a little bit like Ron Paul, reaching out and connecting to those voters who don't feel that the front runners for president, the people who are trying to find the great middle,
speak for them. Exactly. And he's also giving a little, not a little, but a little a tweak at his own Democratic Party. They said, look, what did we win in November of 2006? If George Bush still has his way on the war, if George Bush still has his way on a Mukasey nomination and all these things, what did we win? And so I think that was his purpose of saying, well, it's not the Republican Party who's stopping this resolution from getting anywhere. It's my own Democratic leaders. And so his message to his Democratic leaders is very similar, as you say, to what Ron Paul's message to his Republican leaders, saying this war is crazy, this policy is crazy, the government doesn't hear what we have to say.
We haven't had much to say this week about Hillary Clinton.
Bill has.
But Bill has, and Bill says that she is being subjected to swift boat style attacks. Now, those are fighting words in the Democratic Party, because the swift boat attacks were what put the torpedo in John Kerry's candidacy in the summer of 2004. Now, for Bill Clinton to accuse other Democrats of swift boating Hillary, them's fighting words.
What Hillary Clinton did was to fail to answer legitimate questions without parsing her answer in so many ways.
So Bill Clinton says any kind of attack against Hillary is swift boating.
That was clearly, I don't think that was in the best interest of the Hillary Clinton campaign, because this is not the message that Hillary Clinton wanted to give out. She had a bad debate performance last week,
it wasn't
clearly.
Bad, it just wasn't as good as...
It was her worst. Okay,
it was her worst. It was her worst.
Okay. It was her worst.
And maybe all that means is it was her poorest. It wasn't that it was that bad or she's been that bad.
But the questions of inevitability and the questions of electability really came to the forefront in this debate more so than ever before.
And also this new tack, if you will, to all the media coverage since that debate has put all those questions of inevitability on hold a little bit and given a little more daylight for the other Democratic candidates to run to.
What I thought was also very interesting about this whole debate is that for the first time in memory, Democrats like Barack Obama, like Chris Dodd, others, they criticized Bill Clinton. Now, you don't do that to Bill Clinton.
They fired back.
And you don't do that because, given the fact that there's still a tremendous amount of nostalgia for nostalgia with an R at the end.
Yes, I got that.
The accent. For the Clinton presidency,
he was reelected president as a Democrat.
Right. And how many Democrats
only
have done this?
Only three in the 20th century.
Name them.
Woodrow Wilson.
That's correct.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
And
William Jefferson Clinton.
Wow. Mount Rushmore right there.
That's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
Ron, welcome back to Washington. I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR. Don't be gone, mayor, I will torture you. the podcast is going to deteriorate.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the TL Type S with a 286 horsepower V6 and real-time traffic alerts. Learn more at acura.com.